Well, good morning, friends. My name's Stephen, and I'm one of the pastors here at Granite City. In case we weren't already painfully aware of it, here's the reality of the world that we live in. We are surrounded by suffering. And as it stands this morning, over 28,000 people are dead in Turkey and Syria following two massive earthquakes that happened in that region just a week ago today. Now, some of you have already seen this photo. It's made its rounds. A photo of a man holding hands with his daughter after she was crushed in the quake. I think it's hard. It's hard for us to connect. There's some psychiatrists who argue that the human brain is actually not equipped with the capacity to comprehend tragedy that exists far outside our own circle of familiarity. And yet we live in a world today where we can just see it. We turn and we see an image of something that's happening a long, long ways away. And so we become kind of almost accustomed to seeing these hard images. Thousands dead halfway around the world, and pictures and news reports that our brains can barely compute. But we can relate. We can relate to suffering because it's a commonly shared human experience. But what do we make of pain like this? Ever since there has been suffering experienced by human beings, there have been people who are trying to understand why. Why do we experience suffering? Particularly for people who believe that there is a deity, or for some people throughout history, deities, who have some part to play in this world. And by the way, that's most people who have ever existed on this planet. Those people have tried to understand what part that God or gods play in a world where there is suffering. And the book of Job is an effort made by Yahweh followers to answer this question. Why do we suffer? Why do we experience the world like this? Now, as we've said over the past several weeks, the book actually never answers that question, why? And so we have to kind of dial into what exactly is the book of Job after. But if 28,000 people can die in a moment, what part, if any, does God play in a disaster like that? If my loved ones are going to be taken from me, what part, if any, does God play in that pain? If the dreams in my life are going to be robbed from me, what part does God play in any of this? If we're going to suffer the plight of natural disasters that strike without warning, cancer that strikes without warning, heartache that endures, God-fearing people have to ask, where is God? How do we make sense of this? In December 2004, the beaches in Sri Lanka and Western Thailand and Sumatra, Indonesia, became eerily quiet as the tide seemed to go way out further than it ever had before. Now, what people didn't know at the time was that the third most powerful earthquake ever recorded had already happened deep beneath the ocean. And the tsunami that followed would kill over 200,000 people in moments. And now, almost 20 years later, one of the things that I still remember after that horrific event that, again, was just like, can I even comprehend what's happening on the other side of the planet? And one of the things I remember was people around the world trying to make sense of how something like this could happen. Now, Indonesia was by far the hardest hit by the tsunami. And Indonesia, as some of you may know, is the largest Muslim country in the world. And it didn't take long for people in other parts of the world to say to themselves out loud, this is God's punishment for the evils of Islam. Now, even Muslims in Indonesia were ascending to similar ideas that sounded like this. Their rationale was that this disaster was a punishment for lax adherence to the ways of Allah. And in the years that followed the tsunami, Sharia law was strictly enforced in many of the hardest hit communities, on that island in an effort to make right the sins of the past and hopefully avoid future disaster. Less than a year later, in our own country, one of the worst hurricanes to ever hit the United States made landfall just east of New Orleans, Louisiana. Hurricane Katrina flooded most of the Mississippi Delta area, the most impoverished parts of our country. We're literally drowning. The city of New Orleans was literally drowning. I remember watching on the news as reporters highlighted people around the world celebrating the disaster happening in the United States. Retribution of God against evil America. And the same ideology was right here in our own country. I'll never forget the Sunday after the hurricane hit, our church in Chicago that we were a part of, we gathered in small groups of people on a Sunday morning to pray, and there was a guest at our church that Sunday, and he sat down in our little small group of people, and he prayed about how the hurricane was God's response to the evils of voodoo and the hedonism of Mardi Gras in New Orleans. Now, some of you may agree with a prayer like that. Others may hear accounts like that and think, oh, how backward can we be? How narrow-minded, how fundamentalistic, how primitive. But here's the challenge. At some level, most of us have some sort of retributive view of God and the universe. This retribution principle is a worldview that basically the righteous will prosper and the wicked will suffer. And we may disagree about who the righteous are and who the wicked are based on our religion or our politics or our life experiences or where we were born, right? But the same principle remains intact around the globe. If you do good in this life, you'll receive good. If you do evil in this life, you'll receive suffering. Even Jesus' disciples wrongly, and Jesus corrected them, but even Jesus' disciples wrongly believed this principle to the very core of their being. In John chapter 9, they ask, Rabbi, who sinned? They encounter a blind man, remember? And they say, he was blind from birth. They say, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? That's a retribution principle worldview. And that's how many of us see and experience the world. Let me read to you these words from Job chapter 8. Does God pervert justice? And the people say, no, right? Or does the Almighty pervert the right? And the people say, no. Then we get two sets of if-then statements. Now, if you guys remember those if-then statements from like junior high grammar, it's like basically it's a cause and effect. If this happens, then this happens. And look at what we see in Job chapter 8. When your children sinned against him, he gave them over to the penalty of their sin. That is, if your children do bad, then they get turned over to penalty. But if you will seek God earnestly and plead with the Almighty, if you are pure and upright, even now he will rouse himself on your behalf and restore you to prosperous state. So if you do right, then God will restore. And to which all God's people say, amen, right? So if you do bad, then you get punished. If you do right, then you get good. And we actually see this several places in the Bible. It sounds universally right to us. But the book of Job comes along and it kind of flips that common understanding of the universe on its head. See those words that we just looked at from Job chapter 6, actually. Where's Job chapter 8? Job chapter 8 come from the mouth of Bildad the Shuhite. That's Job's second friend in the cycle of these conversations that he has for several chapters. And if you read all the way to the end of the book of Job, Job chapter 42, where, spoiler alert, we find out that the view of the friends towards Job was in fact wrong. Now, don't misunderstand me here. The book of Job is not saying that God is not a just God. God is indeed a God of justice. Here's the nuance that we need to grasp. Not that God is not a just God, but that the foundations of the universe that God made are not built according to the principles of retribution and justice. The way the world works is not according to justice. And that might shake us a bit to hear that. And it may not come as a surprise to many of us because we live in a world where humanity experiences injustice and catastrophe all the time. Still, though, when we look at the universe and try to make sense of the world, more often than not, our common human reaction is to simplify the world to fundamental cause and effect relationships. So that must be how God runs the universe, right? If this bad thing is done, then this bad thing will be done in return. But the book of Job seems to tell us emphatically, no, that's not how the universe functions. But as we said over the past few weeks, the book of Job does not satisfy us with an answer to the question, why do we suffer? Instead, it goes deeper to help us understand what we can do to engage with the suffering we already experience in the world. Which is why we gave this series through Job this odd title, Yelling at God and Other Lessons from the Book of Job. Because one of the common things that we see from Job throughout this book is a man who is contending with God, a man who demands an audience with God, a man who pleads his case with God. So before we look at the text this morning, just a few basic things that we need to know about Job and his friends. First of all of them are operating under the same assumption that God is just, and we believe that. God is just, and he knows how to run the world, okay? And we can all get on the same page there. All of Job's friends ascribe to a basic retribution principle. What we've just been talking about. The righteous will prosper and the wicked will suffer. Again, this is a common worldview throughout history and it's commonplace today as we've discussed. So what's the inverse then of if you do wicked, you will suffer? Well, the inverse is if you suffer, then you must have done something wicked, right? And that is the unwavering assumption amongst Job's friends. All of the calamity that happens to Job is because he did something wrong. He must have, because that's how the world works, as they saw it. Job, however, knows something that they don't know, or that they at least refuse to believe, that Job is righteous. And that's a problem. That's a big problem. Because if Job is righteous but still experiences awful disaster in his life, loss of family, disease, loss of wealth, etc., if he still experiences all that mess, even as a righteous man, and if God is supposedly a just God who built and sustains the world by way of justice and a retribution principle, well, then God has some questions to answer. The friends now, they refuse to believe that Job is righteous because to do so would crumble their understanding of the universe and God himself. Okay? So Job has been subjected now to three speeches, one from each of his friends, each of them insisting that Job must have done something wrong. Why? Because that's the way the world is supposed to work, right? And as Chris read for us in chapters 12 and 13, one of Job's many responses was this. Let's look at some of these words from Job chapter 13. My eyes have seen all of this. So what they've seen, what they know, Job also knows. My ears have heard and understanding. What you know. I am not inferior to you, Job says. So at this point, Job is feeling ganged up on and belittled a bit by his friends. And that only escalates over the chapters to come. He insists his innocence. He insists that he is guiltless, but they insist his guilt. The irony is that Job doesn't disagree with them, everything that they're saying, everything that he has ever known about the way the world works, that's how Job has understood the world. But Job's paradigm is starting to shift, right? It has to be because he knows he's righteous. So that leaves us with two questions, and really two options. Either God is not the just God that they thought, and he's an unjust God, or the world actually does not operate on retribution and justice. Either way, Job wants an audience with God. So verse 3, he says, I desire to speak to the Almighty and argue my case with God. Verses 15 and 16, though he slay me, yet will I hope in him. I will surely defend my ways to his face. Indeed, this will turn out for my deliverance, for no godless person would dare come before him. So let me pause for a moment and ask all of you, what do you do when it feels like everything is falling apart? I think a common refrain for many of us is to say, what did I do to deserve this? Right? When it happens to loved ones, even when we're just pondering the world, what do we often ask ourselves? Right? Why do bad things happen to good people? Guess what? These are not new questions. These are primal, existential human questions that have been asked for a very long time. And for as long as people have been asking, why do bad things happen to good people? People have been trying to answer that question, trying to make sense of the way that the universe is put together. And the book of Job is right there trying to get underneath the surface of the question, why is this world the way that it is? But I ask you again, what do you do when you feel like everything is falling apart? Through no fault of your own. No correlation of action and consequence. You did what's right, but the result feels so wrong. You lived the right way, but the world paid you back with evil. Mike very vulnerably shared last week of just when hearing some of the worst news in his life, just going and sitting in his car in the middle of the parking garage and just screaming. I'm so grateful that he shared that. Do we feel like we could just scream at God? Do we feel that, like Job, we can ask for an audience with God? Is it a part of your understanding of this world that you might turn to God and say, why is this happening? I want to talk to you about this. Now, here's the amazing thing about the book of Job. Speech after speech, chapter after chapter, Job is saying, I want an audience with God. I want to talk to God, that God agrees. Now, no spoilers, okay? That's like the grand finale of the book of Job. In a few weeks, Mike will be back to talk about that amazing scene of Job speaking to God and God speaking to Job out of the hurricane. Is there anyone here that wants an audience with God? Because I want to encourage you this morning that all of us can contend for the heart of God. The question is, when given the opportunity to chase after God's presence in the midst of our joy and our curiosity and our grief and our suffering, the question is, will we chase? Will we demand an audience? Will we lean in or will we step back? And for those of you who are here today and you're wondering if you actually can approach God, the answer is yes. Yes. And we see throughout this discourse between Job and his friends that Job himself was questioning this. He's wondering, even as he's saying, I demand an audience with God. I want to talk to God. I've got some things to say. I'm innocent, and I need to let him know. I need to plead my case. But even Job himself was questioning this and wondering, can I be in the presence of God? And you can sense this trepidation, even in what some of what Chris read for us this morning. He wrote, this is what Job said. Why do I put myself in jeopardy and take my life in my hands? But Job seemed to instinctively know that to be in God's presence is a fearful act. And it should be. But he's pleading. He wants to make a case before God. And so he asks for God's presence. And look at what he asks for. As you read throughout these speeches, you see these moments where Job seems to understand, I don't know if I can get there. I need help. And look at what he says in Job chapter 9. He, that is God, is not a mere mortal like me that I might answer him, that we might confront each other in court. Listen to this. If only there were someone to mediate between us. Someone to bring us together. Someone to remove God's rod from me so that this terror would frighten me no more. Then I would speak without fear. But as it now stands, I cannot. Job needs an advocate. Is there somebody who can stand in the gap for me, with me? Is there someone who will help me plead my case? Mike, you guys can come on up. 7 chapters later, he renews the same call. He says, even now my witness is in heaven. My advocate is on high. So he seems to know there's somebody who can help me. My intercessor is my friend. As my eyes pour out tears to God on behalf of a man, he pleads with God as one pleads for a friend. And in chapter 9, he builds on this idea that he has an intercessor, that he has somebody fighting for him. He builds on this day that even in his righteousness, he is not without the need of a rescuer. Job 19, verses 25 through 27 says, I know that my Redeemer lives, and that in the end he will stand on the earth. And after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God. I myself will see him with my own eyes and not another. How my heart yearns within me. Job anticipates that as a live, living, in the flesh person, he is going to stand before God. And he knows he needs help. Even as a righteous man. By the way, he's one of three people in the entire Old Testament who are called righteous. Even as a righteous man, Job intuitively understands that he needs representation in the presence of God Almighty. My Redeemer lives. He longs for restoration before his God. He longs for an advocate to be with him. And you say, Pastor, if Job is a righteous man and requires mediation between himself and the Almighty, what chance do I stand? What right do I have to contend for the presence of God? Let me just read to you these beautiful words from Hebrews chapter 4. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weakness, but we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, and yet he did not sin. So let us approach God's throne of grace with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. Man, what a beautiful image. Jesus, our Redeemer, our Advocate, Jesus, our priestly intercessor who stands in the gap for us. Yes, let's approach God's throne of grace with confidence. Jesus gets us. Jesus makes a way for us to approach God. Jesus makes a way for us to ask for an audience, to yell when we're angry, to contend for his presence. In a few minutes, we're going to sing again this beautiful song that just says, there's another in the fire standing there with me. There's another in the water holding back the sea. These are beautiful biblical images, reminders that Jesus is there beside us. Jesus is making a way for us to approach the God who wants for us to tell him we're hurting, who wants to hear from us when we feel wronged. In the next couple weeks to come, we're going to talk a bit more about suffering and how this might fit in to the big picture idea of what's happening in this world. I want to lean more deeply into these existential questions. I know what some of you are thinking. Pastor, you just told us that the foundations of the universe are not built on justice, but you didn't tell us what they are built on. So we're going to tease that out for like one more week, all right? But for now, my hope is that we might be the kind of people who can join with Job in bringing our pain and bringing our suffering and the injustice that we see and feel and experience and lay it down at the feet of our God, who does indeed want to hear us, who wants us to contend for his presence, who wants us to walk into that throne room with confidence. And we can.